It's Tuesday, November 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, a deadly blast rips through an Afghan mosque.
I think not moving forward would undermine our position across the region.
President Obama pushes for free trade in Asia, also ahead an increase in HIV rates. The International Criminal Court under siege, and where to find fantastic beasts. It's all on today's International Edition. We begin with breaking news. An earthquake of magnitude 7.3 has struck off of the coast of Fukushima, Japan, just a short time ago. Early details are sketchy. However, the United States Geological Survey said the quake struck 10 kilometers underground, about 247 kilometers northeast of Tokyo. There was shaking in the capital felt, no immediate reports of fatalities, but Japanese authorities warned of possible tsunamis of up to 3 meters, and already one small tsunami has come ashore. We will keep you up to date as information becomes available. Islamic State has claimed responsibility for Monday's suicide bombing of a Shiite mosque in Kabul that killed at least 32 people and wounded more than 80. The bombing occurred at the crowded Bakir-ul-Ulam Mosque in the Afghan capital during a religious ceremony. International Edition host Sarah Williams spoke with reporter Ayaz Gul in Islamabad, who told her how events unfolded.
Well, what the officials who are involved in investigations currently have said is that a suicide bomber on foot actually stormed this crowded Shiite mosque where a ceremony was underway and detonated the explosives he had strapped to his body. And that was quite a massive explosion because it instantly killed at least 30 people and more than 80 people were taken to hospitals, and they included women and children. So it was quite a massive attack this morning in Kabul.
A brief statement issued by Islamic State's media wing said it was behind the bloodshed. Ayaz Gul described the initial speculation surrounding the bombing.
The Taliban insurgency, which is usually blamed for all such attacks across the country, instantly issued a statement saying it has nothing to do with the attack. But Afghan officials suspect that the Islamic State could be behind this bloodshed because lately there has been an increase in attacks against Shiite Muslims in Afghanistan, and most of the time this Middle Eastern terrorist group has claimed responsibility for such attacks. And I can tell you that on October the 11th, there was a Shiite ceremony underway in Kabul. And there was a massive attack, like there were two suicide bombers who stormed that mosque in another part of Kabul and killed 19 people, and IS quickly claimed responsibility for that. So the suspicions for this attack have also fallen on Islamic State.
Will Shiites have to take greater precautions? I mean, will security have to be tightened in some of these mosques?
Well, that's what, you know, the Shiite community, ever since they have come under attack since July, you know, when there was a massive bombing of a peaceful demonstration of the Shiite community in Kabul and more than 80 people were killed. Since then, there have been demands from this community that the government should increase security around their worship places. But as we know that Afghanistan, especially security forces in Afghanistan, have been struggling to tackle with the Taliban insurgency, and now that they have to deal with this new phenomenon, the Islamic State, which is carrying out these attacks, it's becoming a challenging task for the national security forces there. But the government, you know, President Ashraf Ghani has come out with a very strong statement. He condemned this attack and promised to do everything possible to bring the perpetrators to justice. But so far, we have not seen any significant progress in all these investigations that have been carried out into these attacks against Shiite community in Afghanistan.
Ayaz Gul reporting on the Kabul bombing. The United States denounced the mosque bombing as a senseless and cowardly act and extended its condolences to the families of the victims. It's time now for us to check out what's trending on the web, and for that, our social media reporter G. Abby Lee joins me in the studio. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
Well, I guess we kind of know what's new.
That's right. Like you mentioned earlier, nothing like a breaking news a few seconds before our segment. A tsunami warning has been issued after a 7.3 magnitude earthquake hit northeastern Japan. Motoko Rich, who is the New York Times Tokyo Bureau chief, tweeted, magnitude 7.3 earthquake off coast of Fukushima in Japan. Evacuation warnings for tsunami. And if you go to the NHK English Twitter account, you can watch the live feed there.
And I was just watching that as the water is rising, literally breaking news as we speak.
Very scary. What else
is trending?
President-elect Donald Trump held an off-the-record meeting with some media insiders on Sunday. And even though some of the attendees, commented or tweeted about the meeting, observers still talk about the meeting itself online.
Well, first things first, who were the attendees?
So that's one of the first things you can check out on Twitter, and it looks like the attendees were from the five commercial networks, namely Fox News, CBS, ABC, CNN, and NBC. Some of the household names that attended the event are Lester Holt of NBC, Wolf Blitzer of CNN, and Jeff Zucker, who is a president of CNN International. And there are photos of some of the attendees walking into the venue as well.
Okay. Well, what else are people talking about this meeting?
So one of the points journalists are pointing out is the fact that it was an off-the-record meeting. Jennifer Epstein, who I mentioned in our previous segment, is a politics reporter with Bloomberg, and she tweeted, no pressers for Trump in 12 days since election, and just one major interview. And now TV executives and anchors are meeting with him off the record. So you can feel her frustration from that tweet. The one major interview she's referring to, as you know, is the 60 Minutes appearance. She also tweeted she hopes those in attendance have pushed him to talk not just to their organizations, but to a broader audience. Jim, back to you.
All right. Thanks so much, G, and for that quick reaction and getting some social media reaction to the Japan earthquake. You can follow our program's account at VOA_IE. I'm there at VOA Stevenson. G is at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia, Pakistan reports deadly border clashes with India. Japanese troops armed with new mandate arrive in South Sudan. Is the world's biggest surveillance camera maker sending footage to China? Philippine group wants Marcos exhumed from Hero Cemetery. South Korea begins march towards impeachment. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and also look for updates as they become available on the Japanese earthquake near Fukushima at the voanews.com website. And if you're mobile, try out our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Speaking Sunday at his final Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in Lima, Peru, President Barack Obama said APEC's 21 members remain committed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement reached earlier this year, but opposed by President-elect Donald Trump.
Our partners made very clear during the meeting that they want to move forward with TPP. Preferably, they'd like to move forward with the United States. A number of countries are already starting to ratify TPP. At the same time, we're already hearing calls for a less ambitious trade agreement in the region with lower standards, lower protections for workers, lower protections for the environment. That kind of agreement would obviously exclude U.S. workers and businesses and access to those markets. So for all those reasons, I believe that TPP is a plus for America's economy, America's workers, American jobs. I think not moving forward would undermine our position across the region, our ability to shape the rules of global trade in a way that reflects our interests and our values.
In a statement, the APEC members, while acknowledging rising skepticism over trade, committed themselves to fight protectionism and keep their markets open with or without the United States. Mr. Trump also campaigned on renegotiating a fairer North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, with Canada and Mexico. Economist Gary Huffbauer of the Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics tells VOA's Victor Beatty it's possible the 11 other members of TPP could ratify the comprehensive agreement even if the United States does not.
And the U.S. is the, you know, is obviously the biggest part of the party for most of the other members, but they're still a party, even without the United States. And if they believe, as many of them do, that free trade or freer trade is in their own interests, they could conceivably go ahead and do this. I've heard this theme from Mexico. I was just down in Mexico last week, and I've heard it from New Zealand and even some soundings from Canada, Japan. The only country I've heard of that has shelved the prospect of ratifying TPP apart from the United States is Vietnam.
Donald Trump, the president-elect, says he's not opposed to trade agreements or even free trade agreements, but he is opposed to leaving people behind and losing jobs and being on the wrong end of the stick.
He goes on to say that he's willing to have trade agreements with individual countries. Senator Hatch, chairman of the Finance Committee, Senate Finance Committee, has proposed to the Trump incoming administration and to Trump himself that they should consider a free trade deal with Japan. Well, Trump just met with Prime Minister Abe. You know, it's conceivable that Trump could do some deals with individual countries, though I don't think that's a priority from his standpoint.
Well, he's indicated that he is going to renegotiate the NAFTA agreement, and if the terms are not agreeable to his administration, he'll walk away from it. Is that a disaster?
He has said he'll renegotiate. I believe he will renegotiate. The other countries will come in. We'll have talks, I think, which will extend for at least 6 months or more. If the United States were to completely denounce the NAFTA, in other words, completely walk away and put on a whole raft of new tariffs focused on Mexico, that would be a disaster. That's not the outcome I see. I see that as a threat. I listened to the campaign just like you did and everybody else did. But we have to take some of those campaign statements with a little bit of salt. And I don't think he's going to walk away from the whole agreement.
While China, not a party to TPP, has been pushing its own free trade regime called the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP, with a member of China's delegation to the APEC meeting indicating growing interest in joining the 16-nation bloc, including Peru and Chile. The International Criminal Court in The Hague has been rocked by a series of withdrawals by African countries that were original signatories to the Rome Statute that established the court. Russia has now also pulled its signature from the ICC treaty, and the Philippines could follow. Henry Ridgewell reports that the court could be facing a domino effect of countries quitting its jurisdiction.
Three African states, Burundi, South Africa, and Gambia, signal their intention to quit the International Criminal Court this year, claiming the court disproportionately targets African leaders. Phil Clark is from the London University School of Oriental and African Studies.
There's a real concern right across Africa about the meddling of international actors in African affairs.
Russian President Vladimir Putin removed his country's signature from the founding treaty this week, though it had never ratified its membership. His Philippine counterpart said Thursday he might follow Moscow's lead, claiming that, in his words, only the small ones like us are battered. ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda this week defended the court's actions.
As an international community, we should be more concerned about ensuring accountability and justice for these very serious atrocity crimes.
While some African countries plan to quit, others have engaged more directly with the ICC, says analyst Phil Clark.
Countries like Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo have in fact seen the ICC as a tool that they can use against their military and political opponents. Nigeria is also engaging in discussions with the ICC prosecutor at the moment about potentially opening investigations into crimes committed by Boko Haram.
The ICC is opening its first major investigations outside Africa, looking into potential war crimes in the 2008 Russia-Georgia conflict. It has also begun looking into torture allegations against US and British forces in Afghanistan.
Those, I think, are very important cases because it would enable the court to say, look, we're not just picking on African states, we're also willing to tackle the biggest powers in the world.
But as the United States is not a signatory to the court, any successful prosecution appears unlikely. And analysts say the series of member state withdrawals raises the prospect the ICC will no longer be seen as an institution of global justice. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Ahead of World AIDS Day, December 1st, a new report finds that more people with HIV than ever before are receiving life-saving treatment, leading to fewer deaths from AIDS-related illnesses around the world. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNAIDS headquarters in Geneva.
The report says just over 1 million people died from AIDS-related causes last year, compared to twice that number a decade ago. UNAIDS says this is because of the large number of people with HIV, 18.2 million, who now have access to antiretroviral treatment. The agency also says the world is on track to reaching the target of 30 million people with treatment by 2020. Peter Geese is director of the UNAIDS Strategic Information and Evaluation Department. He tells VOA the disease can be conquered if the necessary investment is made in scaling up HIV treatment and prevention programs.
We estimate that if indeed, like, the funding is there and the coverage targets that are set out to be achieved by the year 2020, then that will lead to ending the HIV epidemic by the year 2030. If the money isn't there, then it is, like, almost impossible to achieve that end.
Currently, the agency has $19 billion to spend on HIV/AIDS annually. UNAIDS estimates it will need $26 billion for each of the next 7 years to achieve its goal of ending the epidemic by 2030. As in previous years, sub-Saharan Africa remains the region with the highest prevalence of HIV/AIDS. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
If you doubt the speed at which the world is changing, just take a look at the digital media. In the last 20 years, the introduction of mobile and internet technology has spawned breathtaking advances in the sharing of information and commerce. Today, an estimated one quarter of the Earth's population uses the services of the internet. Two-thirds of us now own a mobile phone. But these advances into the digital age have been met with problems. Problems like state censorship, hackers, and identity theft, to name just a few. The Voice of America wants to know how the digital world has transformed your life. Or have they? We'd like you to tell us your story by writing or sending videos to our website, Twitter, or Facebook page. Find out more by visiting us at our webpage at voanews.com and then click on Digital Frontier. Tell your story and share it with the world through VOA's Digital Frontier.
This is VOA's International Edition. In Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, filmmaker David Yates recreates the on-screen magical world we came to love in the Harry Potter franchise, but without its iconic characters. Renowned Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling wrote the screenplay introducing the Magical Society of New York City an ocean away from Hogwarts School of Wizardry and long before the story of The Boy Who Lived unfolded. It dominated the box office this weekend, debuting at $75 million. It's a robust opening considering the film cost $180 million to make. And so far, most of the moviegoers have been adults who grew up with the Harry Potter book series and subsequent films. But the studio is also banking on younger crowds once those schools close for the holidays. VOA's Penelope Blue has more.
New York, 1926. A destructive force is loose on the streets of the city.
Whatever it is, it must be stopped.
Living in secrecy, the Magical Society of America is in turmoil, fearing exposure and backlash from the non-magical folk, the non-mag, as they call them.
Impound that case, Graves.
Please, you don't understand. Nothing in there is dangerous.
We'll be the judges of that.
The Magical Congress of the United States of America suspects Newt Scamander is the cause of the outbreak.
It was open?
Just a smidge.
The English magical zoologist who arrives in New York City with a case full of endangered magical creatures plans to release them in their natural habitats. J.K. Rowling says Newt Scamander was the famed author of a textbook Harry Potter used at school.
While I was writing Potter, I became quite interested in Newt Scamander. So I knew quite a lot about Newt. He's been traveling the world studying magical creatures. He calls himself a magizoologist.
First trip to America?
Yes.
Must get that fixed.
Academy Award winner Eddie Redmayne interprets the eccentric Scamander, who finds himself at the epicenter of the crisis when some of his creatures escape. His animals are believed to be responsible for the death and destruction in the city.
You know which of your creatures was responsible, Mr. Scamander?
Look at the marks. No creature did this.
Scamander enlists the help of two witches and Jacob, a non-mage and aspiring baker, who crossed paths with Scamander after the two accidentally switch cases. Jacob's was full of donuts. The wizard sets out to retrieve his escaped creatures and find out who is really behind the attacks. It may come as no surprise that these culprits also afflicted the Harry Potter world decades later.
There are ways in which we connect to the Potter books that I think people will find surprising.
They think this is related to Grindelwald's attacks in Europe.
We're talking about the first time a wizard rose and threatened the world order.
Harry Potter's theme against bigotry and the idea of racial purity is repeated in Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. But while Potter fans can revel in the message and the magic of the new film, the script falls rather flat, and the cast does not quite connect and excite as Harry Potter's did. However, J.K. Rowling promises more to come in the newly developed franchise, and despite this slow start, Harry Potter fans can live on that promise. Penelope Poulou, VOA News, Washington.
I want to be a wizard.
Thank you for listening, and we invite you to join us again for our next International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In recent remarks to foreign journalists, Secretary of State John Kerry emphasized the importance of U.S. engagement in some of the most difficult challenges our world faces. On security, the United States led the effort to form a coalition of over 60 nations that is helping to stop ISIL after it swept across Iraq and Syria, taking over cities, destroying communities, and murdering civilians. After 35 years of diplomatic silence, the United States not only helped start negotiations with Iran, but led the effort that ensured that Iran's nuclear program is and will remain exclusively peaceful. We continue to lead the fight against HIV/AIDS. As a result, said Secretary Kerry, today we're on the brink of seeing the first generation of AIDS-free children being born in Africa. And that's through PEPFAR, the United States program to help provide health care and change lives for people. When the recent Ebola epidemic first arose in West Africa, many predicted that it would claim as many as a million lives before it ran its course. But 3,000 U.S. troops sent to West Africa by President Barack Obama worked with personnel from many other nations to build up local health care capacity. We summoned an international movement, and guess what? Those million people didn't die, said Secretary Kerry. On climate change, the United States made a pact with China that set an example of how to reduce emissions on a global basis, a move that helped set the stage for the signing of the Paris Agreement. We help craft the Kigali Agreement that will end the production and use of hydrofluorocarbons, and we help to set aside millions of square kilometers of ocean in the Antarctic, the Pacific, and the Atlantic to save our waters and fisheries. I have never seen the United States of America more engaged to the benefit of everybody else. In order to try to help other countries work their way through crises, to make peace and stability so we can go home and pay attention to things here, said Secretary of State Kerry. I've never seen us more engaged in more countries at one time on more issues of significance with greater consequence than now.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.